welcome to another edition of Problematic Women, a podcast and Facebook watch show that showcases strong conservative women, current events, and the hypocrisy of the feminist left. My name is Kelsey Harkness, and I'm a senior news producer here with the Daily Signal.
And I'm Bree Payton, staff writer over at the Federalist and friend of the Daily Signal. So we have a great show for you today. We have a lot to unpack. First of all, though, it's necessary that we immediately address Refinery 29's most recent post in Money Diaries, their series in which millennial women around across the United States will diary about their weekly expenses and then blog about it for Refinery 29 anonymously. So in one of the more recent posts on Refinery 29's Money Diaries, a marketing intern in New York City who earns $25 an hour and gets an $1,100 monthly allowance from her parents and lives rent-free in her apartment, she's a cheapskate when she goes out with her friends, and she feels guilty whenever she takes a $4 Lyft line to go home, which is insane to me.
And she has a thing for really fancy yogurt.
Yeah. So, Kelsey, tell us more about this woman's life in New York City.
All right. First off, an internship where she's making $25 an hour, that is a really good internship, and I want to know more about it. So it's not like she's making nothing. Here's a sample of her monthly expenses. Rent. I live in a one-bedroom, one-den apartment. The total rent is $4,050. My share is $2,100, which my parents pay, and my roommate's share is $1,950. Parentheses, she lives in the den. Her student loan payment is $0. She says, I'm still in school and my parents pay for my education. Her health insurance is also $0 because she's also on her parents' plan. Her monthly movie pass is $9.95. And her sugared and bronze pass is $40.76 a month. Parentheses, I get one Brazilian sugaring a month, which
we're not exactly sure what that means.
I attempted to have Brie explain, and I'm still unsure. So go Google it. Brazilian sugaring. Apparently, it's a thing for privileged millennials. Her Equinox membership, which is also a gym for very privileged millennials and New Yorkers. They do have it in D.C. too. It's actually all across the country. $210 a month. That has gone up since I lived in New York City. Her phone bill is zero because she's on her parents' plan. And her Netflix, Spotify, and Amazon payments are $0 a month because, of course, she uses her parents' accounts.
So there's a lot of questions here. Number one, how does she have an internship that pays $25 an hour? I don't get that. Number two, why do her parents and grandparents give her an allowance when she's making, what is it, like $747 every 2 weeks, and they're paying for her rent? Like, I understand, you know, pitching in to help your kid pay for their rent while they're interning in the city, or whatever, to what extent.
She gets $800 a month from her parents, and her grandpa wires her $300 every month.
Hashtag bless. She literally typed that. Hashtag bless. So, like, if this is my kid, I could understand pitching in for part of the rent or something like that, which she makes enough money to cover rent, so I wouldn't do that if I was her parents. But I get sort of, to an extent,
helping
doing that.
A little bit. Yeah.
I don't understand paying for her rent and giving her a spending allowance. Like, I don't understand what the point of that is.
What does she do with the money that she actually makes?
Okay, so this is where we get to the interesting part of this piece, which, do you read Money Diaries normally or
I don't. This was the first Money Diaries I've ever read.
So I read a lot of them, probably most of them, because it's fun to see how other people spend their money, and it's fun to see how people live on all these different amounts of money, like in different parts of the country. Like someone, you know, making $35,000 in Tennessee or something, you're reading their lifestyle and you're like, oh, this, you know, sounds like someone else making a lot more money in the same city that I live in. Maybe I should move to Tennessee. So it's kind of fun to just see, you know, the way that people live. But a lot of times I've noticed that women who make six figures, or in her case, she takes in a good amount of money from, like, her parents and from the free rent that she gets and from her salary. They act like they have to pretend to be frugal or apologize for whenever they spend money. So they'll be like, oh, I took a Lyft line, you know, from work today instead of walking, even though I could have walked, even though I know that, you know, that that's an extra $5. But at least I did the shared option instead of the regular option. So that saved me $2 or $3 right there. It's like fake frugality.
Oh, the sacrifice.
Yeah, it's like fake frugality. It's like, you know what? If you're making, you know, six figures and you're a single person and don't have children, it's fine if you take a Lyft. Like, you don't have to apologize to me as the reader. So that in general kind of annoys me. But let's get to the way that this girl spends her money and how she is cheap with her friends. Which you don't need to be cheap if you're living like that. You could pay for all your friends' things and be the cool friend. All right, so she goes on a girls' weekend to the Hamptons. And so on her way home, she gets a goat cheese and avocado wrap at the local health food store. And this is somehow $23. So I don't get how that's $23. But
the Hamptons, you've never been there.
Besides the point, I actually have not been there. So she's on the girls' weekend. They're on this trip. She spends like $38 on a bottle of rosé in order to take with them, which I don't know why you're doing that if you're going to be frugal about other things. So this is where it gets interesting. So they're all out for dinner. She's out with her friends. This is what she writes. Dinner is delicious. Service is terrible. Food's overpriced. The edamame comes out last, and my steamed veggie dumpling appetizer is forgotten. We get individual checks because some of my friend ordered drinks and some of us got more food. My check is $45. I'm in shock. But I swallow my pride because hashtag Hamptons prices. And then at another point, so she describes like they're all in the Hamptons. They're all going out. They go to, you know, like a bar. So she goes to, she wants to leave. So time to go home. Music gets shuts down, even though the guys who are throwing it have a permit at this house party in the Hamptons. I open Uber and see that an XL costs $76. So I freak out. Maybe I'll wait and see if someone else can stomach calling it. Okay, I'm sorry, but if you're getting an $1,100 allowance, living rent-free, making $25 an hour, you can pony up and get the Uber XL for your friends and spend $76 and not even think twice about it.
But how do you know her friends aren't getting even more monthly stipends from their families?
That's true, but like still, you know, like this isn't going to hurt you. Just be a good friend. So she says, my friends are too drunk and won't leave, so I had to call it. I check Lyft, and a big car is only $33. Two girls in the car play dumb and won't pay me $12.
Okay, Brie, here's what I want to know. Is this real or is it made up?
So that's the thing with these money diaries is that they are anonymous. So potentially someone could make this up and send in a totally fake thing. But number one, that's a lot of work, right? Like this is like hours worth of writing, I feel like, to diary that. So that's a lot of work for a totally fake thing, in my opinion. But it still could be. But I think that there are people that live like this. I mean, I have known people who, while they were, you know, living in D.C., even as adults, like fully with jobs and health insurance and everything, their parents pay for their house or different things like that. So I think that this is not, I wouldn't say common, but does happen.
So I have no doubts that people do live like this. I have probably met some of them. My sister's met more of them. She went to a very, she went to Colgate University, and they, you know, she has some friends who are millionaires. I think a couple of them might be billionaires. And so I've heard the stories. I believe it. What I am struggling with this story is that this girl has absolutely no shame, and she is so out of touch with how arrogant she is, and how complacent she is about her money situation. You think she would, you know, a hashtag blessed doesn't mean you're actually saying, I am so blessed that I don't have to worry about money. Instead, she really seems to be rubbing it in people's faces.
But the thing is, she does worry about money. Like every single purchase that she makes, she's like, oh, I feel so bad about calling the Lyft line. I feel bad about getting this iced coffee. Like I don't want to pay for the Uber XL for my friends. I'm mad that they didn't Venmo me the extra money and I had to pay $12. Like, I don't have a problem with someone, you know, being wealthy. I think like good for them, good for her in this situation. I guess what I do have a problem with or found just really annoying was the part where she was worrying about money and worrying about all these little expenses and worrying about, you know, and being a cheapskate with her friends. And then at one point, you know, it takes a while to get seated at this other restaurant that they're at. So she tells the waiter, we're not leaving here without getting free stuff. Bring us wine. And he does. Like, why are you being that kind of a person when you don't need to be? Like, you can relax, you can have fun. So I guess, you know, the cheapskate aspect of this is what just bothered me.
Well, it's like she's trying to be frugal, but she's so out of touch, she doesn't actually know what it means to be frugal because, you know, with her income, you know, $4 isn't going to make a big difference versus someone in middle of America, $4 would make a huge difference and they would be thinking harder about that decision. I feel like you and I could talk about this story all day, especially in our generation.
We've got to move along.
Because we've seen these types of behaviors. Millennials are always labeled as, you know, privileged and out of touch. You know, I do think if you find this interesting, you might want to go read the whole story over at Refinery 29 and now read more of these diary entries, because I'm going to as well, because it is interesting learning how other people spend their money and in some cases how they save it.
Yes, I definitely think it's interesting. And you don't need to feel bad if you spend your money, and you don't have to apologize in your money diary post. You can just be like, I took the Uber XL. It's fine. It's fine. I don't feel bad.
Hashtag blessed.
All right. Speaking of Uber XL, Kelsey.
Moving on to this story we spotted this week. So women in Saudi Arabia who have just recently earned the right to drive aren't picking no Priuses to drive. They are buying up muscle cars. So this is a story that Bree and I have been following for a long time since the announcement came out that women in Saudi Arabia were going to get the right to drive, which is astonishing within itself. But, you know, they're actually, it's been a long process, and women are now actually getting their licenses and getting on the road. And they're picking really awesome, in some cases, manly cars. So this is from a story in the Wall Street Journal. An Audi spokesperson said, "We expected women to begin with small cars with small engines, but they're looking for big cars with big engines." Brie, I think you have more.
Yes. So this is excerpting from the Wall Street Journal piece. When officials at Ford Motor Company heard that Ms. Nassieff, who is known for having participated in the campaign for women's right to drive, wanted a Mustang, the manufacturer offered to give her one for free. She had asked for the powerful performance car in yellow and black, the colors of her local soccer team, of which she is a diehard fan. Since it was delivered on July 9th, she has been driving the Mustang almost nonstop. She zooms down the palm-lined avenues in her hometown, often with the top down, despite the sweltering heat, giving rides to various groups of her 16 grandchildren. "I love this car because of its roar," she says. "Everybody is staring at me because I'm a woman in a sports car, but why not? We're even better drivers than men, to be honest." So Miss Nassieff keeps one hand on the steering wheel and one other on the horn when she's driving, blasting male drivers who fail to use turn signals or talk on the cell phone while behind the wheel. Both common sins on Saudi roads. "If I see them behave badly, I go beep, beep," she said. "We'll teach them how to drive."
I love this story. I absolutely love it. So I think this woman is actually in her 60s.
Yeah, she's like 65 or something like that.
Which talks
about the grandchildren, so you get the sense that she is a little bit older.
Which is just amazing, because I think it's so hard for us to put ourselves in their shoes of these women who are in their 60s getting their license. So take a step back down memory lane and think back to how excited you were when you first got your license and you first stepped in your car and how free you felt. And it's interesting to use that word free for the feeling that we all feel when we first get our licenses. And that's what they're experiencing right here. But for them, they've had to wait, in some cases, decades to get this right. So I am so excited for them. I was reading more about this. Apparently, there's already a massive backlog in the system for women who are trying to get their licenses. It's a very long and strict process. It's not like walking to the DMV and taking that little test that we do here in the United States. There's driving simulation tests. There's classes they need to take, lectures. They're very, very strict. But then I love seeing on the flip side, now that the women are on the road, they're saying, oh, no, the men are the ones who don't know how to drive.
Probably, because they've taken it for granted this whole time. And apparently driving classes are so backlogged because there's a very limited number of women-only driving schools, because apparently you know, if you're a woman in Saudi Arabia, you have to go to a woman-only school because you can't sit in classrooms with men.
Another thing so that people often forget about.
I know.
Like, men and women are actually separated in this society.
Yeah. So
physically separated.
Yeah. Yeah. Even in colleges, if you're a woman, you have to sit, like, in a like an overflow classroom and watch the instructor on screen. And if you have a question, it's, like, too bad. You have to work twice as hard, and it's twice as hard.
It's so crazy.
Anyway, so there's a huge backlog, and women are trying to go to driving school. So maybe if you're an entrepreneur and you're in Saudi Arabia and you feel like making money off of, you know, teaching women how to drive, this is probably a great venture.
Or, I don't know, if you have a car to donate, send it to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. That'd be a good thing to do. Speaking of Saudi Arabia, it's also a member of the UN Human Rights Council, which we're going to talk about later in the show. But first, we have to talk about high-heeled Crocs.
Another important topic. Equally as important.
Yeah. Which are now a thing, but should they be a thing? So the shoe company known for making their comfy rubber slides, which I wore for years, by the way. People are always shocked when I tell them that. Yes. I'll explain why in a second. But anyway, this company is now making a high-heeled version that run about $44 a pair.
But they're actually so popular that they are selling on other websites for as much as $200 because they are sold out.
Which is crazy.
Believe it or not.
So, all right.
So, okay, Inez Fletcher Stepman, a writer over at The Federalist, had some major beef with these Crocs.
She's the resident
heels.
Fashion doctor
yes.
over at The Federalist.
She
diagnoses all the fashion crimes in humanity.
She has some opinions. So I wanted to read what she had to say, just a couple short sentences, and then Bree and I will discuss. So this is from Inez. If you want a comfortable shoe, please, please, please just wear flats. Wear a chic, pointy toe ballerina, a loafer, a sneaker, one of those hideous but trendy dad sneakers that look like they belong on the set of Seinfeld, even an actual Croc. For the love of everything that is holy, wear literally anything except this mangled half-breed of a water shoe and the once beautiful pump. Wear your flats proudly and reject the bastard spawn of two defensible options, comfort and style, that is the Croc heel, the shoe that isn't too impractical to wear, the shoe that is too impractical to wear on a river hike, yet too ugly to allow in a restaurant. That's a good line. Because the only worse thing than a Croc heel is this one from Balencia, which for those of you watching on Facebook Watch, we have a picture of that costs $900.
Yeah, that's a sin. I don't think you should be spending $900.
And for those who are listening on the podcast and you're wondering what this $900 shoe is from Balencia, it's basically a platform Croc with some spikes on it and a few pins, black, kind of scary looking. Hard to understand why anybody would wear it, and I would say it is arguably much worse than the Croc heel.
So I actually, all right, I wore Crocs for years. I'm a ceramic artist and I do ceramic art, which is, you know, you make clay like pots or bowls or whatever on a wheel.
Wear
these. Yeah. I haven't been doing it for a while because I haven't found a good studio in DC that's not like crazy expensive to join as a member. But I did do this for a number of years in California.
What did you make?
I made a lot of bowls and I made a lot of mugs and I made like some flower pots that my parents use. And I actually got really into making hollow eggs at one point and just made like 30 hollow eggs.
All right. Anyway, one day we're going to have an outing. I'm going to take a
video
I'll
teach you.
Of Bree doing ceramic and we'll show you all on Facebook Watch.
Okay. This will be fun. Anyway, so this is what I do. And I wear them in the studio all the time because they're really comfortable. And I don't know, they're just like good studio shoes. If you spill clay on them, you can rinse them off and it doesn't matter. So I like them. I think that they're a practical shoe. I think that the Croc heel, I have mixed feelings, but, you know, I kind of have a soft spot for like weird new shoes, like those five toe shoes that everyone was doing for a while. I kind of like wanted
I have a pair.
Pair
of those, but you I did? Got, I got them for free.
I wouldn't spend like $200 or whatever on them, but if someone gave them to me, I'd be like, oh, sure,
they're
for sure,
really,
I'm about them.
They're really hard to run in because they provide absolutely no support.
I was wondering if they would hurt, like hitting the webbing.
Not
did they
really.
Do that? Okay.
No. I'm really surprised, though, that you are defending the croc heel. I wasn't prepared for that. I actually was prepared to defend it, too. So I guess it's you and I against Inez here. Okay, so if you go to a hospital, you see a ton of people wearing Crocs for the reasons you just described. They're so practical. They're comfortable. They're stable. And they're easy to clean up. They're easy to put on and take off. I mean, are they ugly? Yes, but I don't care that much about what my shoes look like. There's certain situations when practicality is far more important. So I'm trying to think through, like, why would you ever want the Crocs with a heel on it, though? Because, you know,
that's where I'm torn.
That's a step further. And okay, what I came up with, it's hard for, I think, either of us to understand because we're both tall. We're both about 5'9". But, you know, if you're really short, I mean, say you work in a hospital and you want comfortable shoes, you might just want to feel a little bit lifted. I mean, I feel empowered because I'm tall sometimes. And I think other women like to feel the same. So if they can have a shoe that gives them a little bit height but is still really comfortable and practical, then hey, more power to you.
I agree. I agree with you there. And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break. Don't go away. And we're back with our next segment called This Is What Feminism Looks Like, where we uphold positive examples of feminism. So this week, Meghan McCain, co-host of ABC's The View, helped a woman with glioblastoma, the same cancer that her father, John McCain, is so bravely fighting. So she helped this woman meet Taylor Swift last week. Let's watch.
Of all the nasty things that are going on in the world, this is really nice. Over the 4th of July, I was home on my computer on Twitter, I mean, for a little bit, and I saw this tweet retweeted, and it said, my best friend Lexi was diagnosed with brain cancer, glioblastoma, in December. We're going to the Reputation Stadium Tour on July 14th in Philly, and it's her dream to meet at Taylor Swift 13th. So this was tweeted by Lexi for her 21-year-old best friend Lexi Caviston, who's from Pennsylvania. She has the same brain cancer my dad does, glioblastoma, and her dream was to meet Taylor Swift. So I tweeted back seeing this. I was like, we got to make her meet Taylor Swift. Hey, Taylor Swift, we've never met, but anyway, can you meet Lexi at her concert in Philly? She's fighting the same glioblastoma cancer my father has, and this would make both of our days, XO Megan. So it started getting pickup online, as things do sometimes. It got some local media attention. I messaged the show, and I was like, I know we're on a break. Please, can we make this happen? It would make my day. Come to. She got to meet her yesterday. She said it made her day. Oh, wait. Sorry,
Hello?
Hi, this is Meghan McCain. Can I please speak with Lexi?
Hi, this is Lexi.
Hi, Lexi. I'm happy to talk to you on the phone. And I just wanted to call you that we finally got a little magic to work, and you are going to meet Taylor Swift tomorrow.
Thank you, Meghan. Thank you so much. I'm crying right now.
Of course. I'm so excited we could make it happen. We are going to send a car to pick you up so you don't have to worry about driving and to take you there. And I just hope you have an amazing time. And obviously following you on social media, I just think you're so brave. And I'm so happy we could make this happen.
Thank you so much. I can't even express like how amazing this is. Thank you.
It's happening.
So awesome. Nice. So good. So, first of all, she's wearing an Optune cap, which is something that people with glioblastoma have to wear. Saturday morning, Lexi got ready and headed off to meet Taylor Swift, her favorite artist of all time.
Look at
6 p.m. Saturday night, she finally met her. Oh. I am so happy that we were able to help Lexi forget about her cancer for one day. She spoke with our producer and said it was by far the best day of her life.
Amazing.
I just really want to thank Taylor Swift and her entire team. Mm-hmm. Class act. She's an incredible artist, obviously. Love her fans. And, you know, it's just bringing a little light in a world, and it's totally ABC, and Taylor has been a friend of the show for a long time, and we are deeply grateful. I and my family are deeply grateful. Lexi,
and thank you for doing that, Meghan.
She messaged me a picture on Sunday of her at Taylor, this, she messaged me this picture on Sunday. Or Saturday night, it was like really late. And I woke my husband up and I started crying. And I was like, she met Taylor!
Oh, I have goosebumps. Those are two of my favorite people, Meghan McCain and Taylor Swift. When their powers collide, it just creates beautiful, beautiful things. So I think we need to give a shout out to Meghan McCain for putting that together. That really, I'm sure, made a world of difference to Lexi, who is battling a very serious form of cancer. And I also have to give a shout out to Taylor Swift. Brie and I are both Swifties. That's actually how we first bonded over our love for Taylor Swift. But I cannot believe Brie did not go to the Taylor Swift concert when she was here in the DC area. I did, of course. I've gone to her concert every year. And every year she puts one on. She just blows me away. I want to encourage anyone who has daughters or granddaughters to go get a ticket. It really is worth it. The level of production in her concert is insane. You only get that from the biggest pop star in the world. But then what I think is so powerful about her performances is she'll go from a performance with fireworks and all these flying stages going around, and then she'll go from that to just picking up her guitar and just singing her and her guitar, and you see how talented she is musically and vocally, and to see that paired next to the crazy, crazy level of production, I think is really amazing, and it's something I will never forget. This really is a tour that is worth getting out there for, and I think Taylor Swift is such a good example for young girls and women, so go check it out. Reputation.
Absolutely. And with that, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more after this.
And we're back, and it is time to crown our Problematic Woman of the Week. So this week, Brie and I are very excited and honored to give it to our UN Ambassador, Nikki Haley. She is probably my favorite woman in the Trump administration. I think she's been killing it in her position. And she just this week was at the Heritage Foundation, one floor upstairs from here, where I had the opportunity to see her speak in person about the United Nations Human Rights Council and the United States decision to pull out of that. So in this speech, which is a major public speech for her, she slammed the UNHRC as the greatest failure of the UN. The backstory of this is that the United States pulled out of the United States Human Rights Council in June. Of course, this doesn't sound good. How do you explain that we're pulling away from a Human Rights Council? But Nikki Haley did a pretty good job laying out the reasons for that decision. Here is a clip.
The Human Rights Council has provided cover, not condemnation, for the world's most inhumane regimes. It has been a bully pulpit for human rights violators. And the Human Rights Council has been not a place of conscience, but a place of politics. It has focused its attention unfairly and relentlessly on Israel. Meanwhile, it has ignored the misery inflicted by regimes in Venezuela, Cuba, Zimbabwe, and China.
So I'm going to read a little bit from a piece that our intern, Juliana, wrote covering Nikki Haley's speech. She writes that 62% of the Human Rights Council's members are non-democratic countries, nations like Venezuela, China, and the Republic of Congo, which all have clear human rights violations. They all have a seat at the council. So Haley noted that even as mass graves were being discovered in the Republic of Congo, the council was approving the country's bid to be part of it.
Which is insane,
yeah,
by the way.
It's insane. And these aren't the only illiberal nations that are on the list. Afghanistan is also on the list, as well as Iraq, as well as Cuba, which literally jails dissidents and LGBT individuals. So I think there's some pretty big human rights violations there. And yet they're weighing in on policing the world on this. Right. So she also talks about the way that The UN Human Rights Council has singled out the nation of Israel just for the mere fact that they exist, right? Like, they haven't criticized things that Israel has done, but they've been like, oh, Israel needs to go away because they exist and their mere existence is a human rights violation, which is insane. So anyway, Nikki Haley has been opposing that. I think her reasons are sound. I think that she did a really good job of explaining why the United States is pulling out of the Human Rights Council, because it's a joke and because it, you know, basically provides cover for dictators and thugs and human rights violators. So it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. I think that that's all very clear. And yet there's been a lot of pushback from the left. So Elliot Engel, the top Democrat on the House committee that oversees the State Department, said that by withdrawing from the council, we lose our leverage and allow the council's bad actors to follow their worst impulses unchecked, including running roughshod over Israel. So, however, this administration's approach when it sees a problem is to take the United States off the field, he added. That undermines our standing in the world and allows our adversaries to fill the void. So I understand what he's saying here, but I mean, the Human Rights Council is doing the opposite of what it's supposed to be doing. I think by being a part of that, you're complicit.
Completely complicit in what's
going on here, right? And that's something that the left loves to criticize members of the Trump administration and even the members of the Trump family for being complicit. for being complicit, right? So I think in this case, they should see, okay, clearly they would be complicit in providing cover and helping bad actors perpetuate human rights violations by legitimizing them, by granting them a seat on this table, and by pulling out. I mean, listen, we spend the most on the UN. We spend the most when it comes to NATO. We spend the most when it comes to international and foreign aid. So I think our decision to withdraw definitely weakens the position of the UN Human Rights Council. And I think that does more damage and does more than it would be to just sit on there and be quiet and let Iraq tell us what are and what are not human rights violations.
And it's important to note that during the speech, you can check out the whole thing over on heritage.org. It is worth watching and understanding the reasons why Nikki Haley made this decision. But she pointed out that the United States is still going to lead the way when it comes to human rights violations. She personally has visited a lot of these refugee camps. She has met with the women and the children who have been severely abused. She understands it. And she really believes this is the best decision for them because she cannot be complicit in covering in providing cover for countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo that still have mass graves. She also said internally, she touched on the internal politics of the UN Human Rights Council, and it basically sounded like one big joke where a lot of the member nations know that this has turned into a joke because there's so many countries on the Human Rights Council that are actively committing human rights abuses and they're doing nothing about it. So I think she made the right decision. I am all team Nikki Haley on this. And these are issues I really care about. They are often not talked about enough. Human rights issues are something we are constantly trying to address on this show and bring more attention to because, you know, as women who, whether we identify as feminists or not, I think we need to have a voice for a lot of the human rights violations that women are facing every day around the world. And on that note, that's a little serious, so I want to end with something a little more lighthearted. I loved the way that our president of the Heritage Foundation, Kay Coles James, introduced Nikki Haley yesterday. She said this is one of her favorite quotes from the UN ambassador. Quote, I wear heels and it's not a fashion statement, it's ammunition. I'm going to say that from now on, if anyone wears my heels. And you know what? If you're wearing Croc heels, you have a right to say that too.
Exactly. Yes, you have ammunition, albeit rubber. Well, that wraps our show this week. Thank you so much for tuning in, as always. And if you know problematic women, and we should give her a shout out, please let us know. You can follow all of my work on Twitter @Bree_Payton and read all of my work over at thefederalist.com. And you should check out that report about Nikki Haley's speech here that Juliana wrote for us. She's an intern at The Federalist. Shout out to Juliana.
And you can follow my work at The Daily Signal and on Twitter @KelseyJHarkness. This This podcast is a collaboration of The Daily Signal and The Federalist, and today it was produced by Thalia Rempesad of The Daily Signal. If you like this podcast, please support us by rating and subscribing on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate you sharing it with your friends and for supporting strong conservative women who are standing up for America's culture.